Welcome to part two of our episode on offshore finance with Brooke Harrington and Herbert Chang from Dartmouth College. Now, in the first episode, you heard all about the world of offshore finance and how Brooke became interested in it and actually trained in it to better understand how it worked. And you heard a little bit from Herbert on his background in data science and how he began to collaborate with Brooke, particularly after these data leaks, to better understand how the networks in offshore finance actually worked. Now, in this episode, we're going to talk about their findings. We're going to talk about the many different reasons people actually use the offshore finance system. And we're going to end by talking about how do we deal with this issue. Brooke's going to talk about why so many of the interventions into dealing with this issue of offshore finance have failed. And we're going to talk about how the findings of their research give us a different way to tackle this problem. This is Simplifying Complexity, a podcast where we explore the underlying principles of complex systems. Systems that seem to defy our rational view of the world, like economies, ecologies, or even you or me. I'm forensic engineer Sean Brady, and I'll be your host. So the smaller number of intermediaries is a sign, you see that in the authoritarian regimes, and it's a sign of that need for even, you know, I trust this person, so you trust this person. So that leaves that rather than you get a broad spread of those people, you get really powerful nodes. Is that fair?
Yes. And one of our case studies, so the first part of the paper is to look at these four regimes from a macro scale. And then the second part of the paper is to look at like 44 sanctioned Russian oligarchs at the time, and then look at what their network looked like. And then 26 of those sanctioned oligarchs we found in the database. And then we found that they were connected by a mere like 125 or 126 nodes. So all it took was just that many nodes to connect all 24 of them. So they exist in a very dense network. So that was the first one. That's this power law structure.
So just on that, listeners would have heard lots about power laws. We had Jeffrey West on and we had Neil Johnson on talking about war casualties. And you're fundamentally saying you're seeing the same structure, this, you know, which we typically attribute with complex systems, in the network structure of the data.
Yes, precisely.
And is that the cause of that preferential attachment that we see in other power laws where the more friends you got, the more friends you get type thing? Is that what you think is behind it, or is there another mechanism producing the power law?
This is where the qualitative data becomes invaluable, because the context that I have is hearing six dozen wealth managers telling me about how, in order to do their jobs, remember I said they describe themselves as social workers? Well, as one of them put it, no one can fire me because I know where all the bodies are buried. Like, I know about all the family scandals. I know about the kids who are on drugs. I know about the kids that were born out of wedlock. I know who's cheating on whom. And, you know, I know who's double dipping on the family fortune. So they trust me, but also even if they don't like me, they can't fire me, because how are they going to get anyone else up to speed on their private affairs? And if they were to fire me, they'd have to start from scratch and explain all that stuff from zero to someone else. And that means the more people who know about all their dirty dealings, the more mouths can blab about that to journalists or to regulators or prosecutors. So scale that up to the, say, just under 3,000 people in the world who are billionaires. They don't find a hairdresser or a housekeeper from the phone book. They have very serious trust and security issues. There's a lot at stake if they're taken advantage of it, if their trust is betrayed. So what they do to find any sort of professional help is they ask their friends, who's a good wealth manager? Who are you going to share the family secrets with? So what that means is that patterns of wealth manager and client relationships often reflect networks of elite sociability, basically which rich people are friends or family with other rich people, because those are their trusted networks, and they end up picking wealth managers from that very limited group of people who are already vetted by people they know and trust. And that means that in our PNAS Nexus paper that was published last year, we showed that like all three Rotenberg brothers, the Rotenbergs are Russian oligarchs who were martial arts partners of Vladimir Putin for decades. So he trusts them. The Rotenberg brothers trust each other, at least insofar as there's honor among thieves. So the Rotenberg brothers all use the same wealth manager. And many Russian oligarchs end up routing their business through the same wealth managers because there's a very limited number of people who are professionals who can do what the Russians need to have done, but who can also be trusted to keep the mouth shut.
And when you then go to the US, do you see the same structure, but it's a lot less dense? Is that the fundamental difference?
To get back to the question about preferential attachment, I think what we're seeing here is instead of the motivation being perceived popularity, like, oh, everyone's friends with Sean, so we should be friends with like perceived popularity, it's very much driven by this need for trust and secrecy that Brooke had just mentioned. And so I think perhaps one of the distinctions needed to be tested, but between democratic and authoritarian regimes might be the different motivations that cause preferential attachment. So if it's like everyone's using this wealth manager and it's like something everyone can do, then it becomes an issue of perceived popularity in like democratic countries. But again, this is speculation, hypothesizing. So yeah. The networks in, at least that we found in the democratic regimes are less dense, or at least the distribution has a less of a heavy tail.
That's what I was going to say. It's still a parallel, but it's a different slope. Is that fundamentally the difference between the two of them?
Yes, exactly.
So that's really interesting. So you got parallels, but different slopes because there may be different motivations. You mentioned obviously the importance of Russia with the war in Ukraine. How much of a difference in the world is there between your motivation being, I suppose, to avoid paying tax versus your motivation of getting money out of the country so you can use it in different ways that like you might, I'm just purely speculating, you might see in Russia?
The issue for people from autocratic countries is not that they don't want to pay tax. It's that they don't want to say the wrong thing one day and have the ruling regime seize all their assets and pauperize them overnight. For some of your listeners who might be of a more quantitative bent, they might be thinking, well, you know, it's nice that you were able to generate hypotheses from qualitative research, but we'll take it from here now. You know, we've got these big data sets, we've got the network analysis and complexity science techniques, we don't need the qualitative data anymore. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this project is it shows how deeply entwined the two methods and the two ways of knowing things really are. Because you might look at the patterns, the complex networks that we found and say, oh, all these people are just trying to escape taxes. And you'd really miss the point. You'd miss the point of why we found that these offshore networks of Russian oligarchs were structured in this hub and spoke system known as a scale-free network. The reason they're like that is because all these people are terrified, not of the tax man, but of Putin or some other warlord effectively seizing all their wealth. So step one in making sure Putin can't do that or some other rival warlord can't do that to you is you get the money or the wealth out of Russia. You get your family out of Russia too. So the name of the game for these people is whether they're from Russia or from the PRC or from Kazakhstan. I'm blanking for some reason on names of dictatorial countries, but the common denominator, no matter where those countries are in the world, is dictators commonly punish dissidents or former allies who criticize them by giving them what you might call the Khodorkovsky treatment. Do you remember a guy named Mikhail Khodorkovsky? Well, 20 years ago, he was the wealthiest man in Russia. He was one of the oligarchs who had bought up Russia's national assets after the fall of the Berlin Wall. He was fabulously wealthy, and he was right by Putin's side as Putin rose from being the mayor of St. Petersburg to the head of state of modern Russia. And at one point, he thought enough of himself, this Mikhail Khodorkovsky, to say, hey, Vladimir, you are getting way out of line. You're corrupt. This needs to stop. Kind of the classic tale that we've seen in history in feudalism, where the boyars or the feudal lords stand up to the king and say, back off. You know, you're milking the people too much, or you're flouting the law too much. And sometimes, as in the case of the Magna Carta, the king backs down. But a lot of the time, what the king does is like execute the rivals or imprison them, which is what happened to Mikhail Khodorkovsky for a decade, and seize all their wealth. So that's what Putin did. He made an example of Khodorkovsky. And so all the oligarchs after him kind of fell into line. And I don't know if you've noticed, but dictators around the world observe each other and they follow each other. So like Viktor Orban in Hungary observes what Putin is doing, you know, watches him try different strategies and learns from that and applies it in Hungary. Trump watched Orban and applied it in the United States. So by the same token, the oligarchs and the nobility of sorts, they observe what happens to the ones who stand up to the dictators and they go, oh, I'm going to keep my mouth shut, but I know that at any time I might say the wrong thing to the wrong person and then it's game over. So the only way that I keep my billions is I put it someplace that the dictator has no power, like Singapore or like Bermuda. Actually, the favored places are the ones that are closest to British law. In many islands in the Caribbean that are nominally independent countries, they still have a legal system that's tied to the old colonial system based in London. And so if you have a dispute over a trust or some offshore holding that you've based in British Virgin Islands is like this, the ultimate court of appeal is actually physically based in London. And so if you're an oligarch looking to escape the power of a dictator, you really want that. You want that rule of law that you can count on, that it will be applied impartially, even though you're taking advantage of it. That's one of the interesting paradoxes of these oligarchs using the offshore system. They're not anarchists. They don't want to destroy the rule of law or the state. They just want to destroy the ability of the state to constrain them. But they want the state to be able to constrain other people in order to protect the oligarchs' private property rights and their contract rights. So it's kind of like a tails I win, heads you lose kind of situation.
Would you say the motivation for this in democratic countries is tax related? And if it is, once you come out of those countries, is the system that sort of permits all this largely the same, even though the motivations for getting into it might be different?
Yes. I'm glad you brought me back to the issue of like, what are these people actually escaping from? You might notice in our data that there's a substantial portion of people using the offshore system who are from countries that don't have any tax at all, like the UAE, for example, or Saudi Arabia. Now, why do you imagine people who are not subject to tax would want to use the offshore financial system? Why don't they keep their assets close to home? Well, one of the reasons is like, if you're a lieutenant of Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, maybe you look at him cross-eyed one day, or one of your family members says a crossword about him, and he's like, okay, Sean, you're going to prison and I'm taking all your wealth and all your family's wealth. So there's the autocracy problem. But there are other problems as well. Like in certain countries, those governed by Sharia law, but also those governed by civil law, which is to say all of continental Europe, much of South America, you don't have the right to say what happens to your wealth after you die. It's a practice called forced heirship. In the common law world, we're used to having complete testamentary freedom, which means if we hate our families and we want to leave all of our wealth to our pet dog or something, we can do that. And every so often you'll pick up the newspaper and you will see cases where people have done exactly that. Well, you can't do that in civil law countries. And you can't do that in Sharia law countries. The state decides what happens to your assets, and they'll give you maybe you get to decide what happens to 30% of your estate, but the rest is dispersed by the state. Some people really don't want that. Like the Arab world is apparently full of billionaires who have daughters and they want their daughters to inherit equally to their sons. Well, that's not allowed under Sharia law. So how do you fix that problem? You put a bunch of your assets offshore where it's not subject to Sharia law anymore, and you leave instructions to your trustee, I want all of my children to inherit equally regardless of their gender. Boom, done. If you happen to be involved in some sketchy activities that would be illegal in your home country, you don't want the assets you're using to make yourself a fortune to be legally registered in your home country. You want them to be registered in a country that either has legalized what you want to do, whether it's, you know, arms trading or drug trafficking or what have you, or it turns a blind eye. It doesn't have the state apparatus to regulate and enforce the law. You don't care as long as they enforce your property rights and your contract rights. So that's why people will put assets in super sketchy places like Niue, you know, this speck of an island in the middle of the South Pacific. Mossack Fonseca, the lawyers at the center of the Panama Papers, they flew out to Niue and tried to strong arm the government of the whole country into making special rules bespoke or tailored just for the interests of Mossack Fonseca clients, because even Panama wasn't lax enough for what they wanted to do. And that happens all the time. I had wealth managers bragging to me routinely, oh, Malta approached me and said, hey, Mr. X, we hear that you have lots of Azerbaijani oligarch clients and we want to attract more of those clients' business. Why don't you tell us what their wish list is and we'll pass those laws? Or if you're an attorney, why don't you draft some legislation and we'll pass it? And then you'll get your Azerbaijani clients to put some assets in Malta.
The papers you wrote, the first paper and the networks and the dense network for the autocratic countries compared to the democratic ones. What was the next research after that, Herbert?
Yeah, so it's very much related. One of the big questions that we had was, okay, what can we do about this? We have these networks. How can we limit the influence of the offshore system potentially? And one of the things we consider is like, in parallel, there was also news coming out about how ineffective the sanctions on the Russian oligarchs were. So I think there was a big yacht of Alisher Usmanov. He's like a oligarch. And then his yacht was moored in Hamburg in March for a very long time. They knew it was probably related to him. It was probably his. But the authorities could not seize the vessel because they weren't able to verify that that was actually his, because I think it was registered to a company based in Malta, et cetera, et cetera. So many layers there. And so the next thing that we did was we did something called knockout experiments. So we have this big network. Let's find some of these most important nodes, we think. And then once we knock it out, how does the network change? Does the robustness of the network change? Does it become fragmented? And so what we realized was that the networks of the autocratic countries were actually way more susceptible to these knockout attacks, given that you find the right node to knock out. And so once we knocked out one or two of these intermediaries in the Russia and the Chinese networks, then we saw a huge fragmentation and a loss of robustness in the network.
And that's because of the concentrated nodes and there's so few powerful nodes. So when you knock them out, you really hammer the network. What do you do after that?
The policy implication there is by sanctioning these intermediaries, it might be a more effective way of causing the network to fall apart. But we basically tested a bunch of different ways of finding the right knockout targets. For instance, we could use the most popular ones. Like this would be like the total degree. But we found that actually looking at betweenness, which is like sort of the bridgeness of a network is, might actually be more effective in certain circumstances as well.
What do you mean by that? We had Matthew Jackson on and he talked about betweenness, but remind me what betweenness is in the network sense.
The betweenness of a node or like a person in the network describes how essential that node is to keeping the entire network sort of connected. So we typically associate this with like information brokers. They might not be super popular, but they connect information from one side of the network to another side of the network. And this is in contrast to perhaps like very popular nodes or in the network where they're sort of embedded in local hubs as well.
So you said there, Herbert, that trying to knock out the popular nodes wasn't as effective as trying to knock out the brokerage or the between the nodes with high levels of betweenness.
Rather, its popularity is not sufficient. It also has to carry a certain level. It's not the most popular nodes that were the most effective, but perhaps nodes that were just a little bit less popular, but also had a high level of brokerness as well.
Could I just jump in and say, like, if you think about this in a concrete manner, the person who manages Vladimir Putin's wealth probably doesn't have a lot of other clients because Putin is such a big client himself, and he probably has some rules about, well, you can't have any other clients because I don't trust you to be, you know, diverted by someone else. You have to be at my beck and call 24/7, 365. I'm just speculating here. I don't know this, but it's common among the wealthiest people to basically monopolize a wealth manager. In terms of popularity, that the network diagram would show the node that is that wealth manager would not be popular, but they'd be powerful. And that's what we care about, is power, not popularity. So you can have a lot of clients, but that actually might signify that you have to have a lot of, say, upper middle class or poor wealthy clients. You know, the people only bring you $1 million a piece. That means you're not a big player. So you might be have numerous connections, but you're not actually the sort of person we're interested in. We're interested in the advisors to the really big fish in the world. Those are the people who end up getting sanctioned. So we want to find ways to understand where power is based, how these networks show us the structures of economic and political power in the world, not necessarily popularity.
And what's the big takeaways, Brooke, from the research so far in terms of, you've talked about, well, you mentioned hub and spoke, so you probably should talk about that a little bit. But what has all your research been bringing together told us so far that, well, we couldn't, you know, quantitatively prove before?
The first one was the most important implication of my earlier work on offshore finance, which is that the important people are not the rich people, but the wealth managers. They're the ones who actually keep this whole offshore system functioning. And if you could somehow wave a magic wand and disappear all the wealth managers in the world, things like Russian oligarchy or PRC state corruption would be severely impaired, because the wealthy people, the people whose faces end up plastered on the gossip rags, like, ooh, we caught the Queen of England having offshore accounts, those people don't manage their own money. They benefit from the work of expert professionals. And if you remove those expert professionals from the equation, the whole system falls apart. That's methodologically what Herbert was able to figure out with those knockout experiments. What we were doing is running the experiment. What if we could wave a magic wand over the world and knock out some of the most important and powerful wealth managers in the world, the ones who serve the billionaire oligarchs? And lo and behold, what it means is you don't really have an offshore system anymore. The implication for that is that policymakers have been going about sanctions and addressing offshore abuses all wrong, because virtually all of the efforts have been directed at the rich people, the beneficiaries of the system, without fully taking on board this essential concept from common law, which is the whole system runs on divided ownership. Yes, they're beneficiaries. They're people who are driving around in Maseratis and they have chateaus in France and they're living the high life. But they don't create the offshore structures that make it possible for them to have that. It's the experts who are in the background and ignored. And that's part of the reason that 20 years worth of blacklisting of offshore financial centers, many, many efforts to sanction rich people in various ways for taking their assets offshore, it's just been failure after failure after failure after failure. It's because they're not targeting the right people. They're targeting the spokes and not the hubs. The hubs are the professional wealth managers. And that was the very clear implication of my qualitative work, but I couldn't prove it. With the admittedly limited but copious data that we have now, we can show that that proposition holds up at scale.
So what would effective intervention at that particular part of the network look like? Have you any ideas, Brooke?
Yeah, so it looks like sanctions on wealth managers, on the professionals. And that doesn't mean putting the wealth managers out of business. It just means saying to the wealth managers, you can't work with certain clients. So, you know, if you try to open a bank account in many countries, they'll do a little background check on you. And if they see anything sketchy about you, they won't even let you open a savings account. Even if you show up with like a $100 bill in your hand, I want to open an account, they won't take your money if they have strict financial regulations, because if somehow you got that $100 bill from illegal activity, then the bank is on the hook for abetting your crime by allowing you to launder it through one of their accounts. So they just won't take you as a client. the idea of saying we're going to sanction financial institutions or financial professionals or legal professionals by saying you can't work with certain clients is widespread and accepted in many domains. It hasn't really been applied to the idea of the Russian oligarchs who helped Putin invade Ukraine, but it's starting to take off, in part because after my first book on offshore came out, the European Parliament was having hearings about, you know, what are we going to do about this bombshell that is the Panama Papers? We're leading money to offshore. And so they had people like me and other offshore scholars come in and give it our best shot. And then I got to talk several times to the OECD, which is this 38 country organization that sets a lot of the world's economic policy. And I told both of those organizations, you need to target a different group of people than you've targeted so far. Look at the professionals. There's also a model for trying to constrain the damage that professionals can do in the way that scientific knowledge was regulated after the Cold War. In the nuclear era, there was always this danger that scientists who knew how to build atomic bombs would be tempted to get rich by selling what they knew to enemy nations of their home countries or their adopted countries. And so very stiff penalties were instituted to punish people for doing that, to sanction them for sharing their expertise with the wrong people, however the wrong people were defined. And there's famously in American history, a couple, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, were executed for espionage. They shared their expertise with the Russians and it cost them their lives. A much lower key version of that is found in the laws that the US and the UK and the European Parliament have all passed in the past couple of years, especially since the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, saying if you're an accountant or an attorney or you're involved in offshore corporate services and you're a citizen or resident of the European Union, the UK, or the US, you are forbidden from working with this list of sanctioned individuals. And if we catch you, we're going to put you in prison and hand you a six-figure fine. So you can practice your profession, use your expertise, but not with those people.
So that has happened, and that's the beginning of targeting the right part of the network.
I believe so, because if you take the professional expertise out of the equation, it's going to be really hard to fill that vacuum. You're not going to see people like Alisher Usmanov sitting on the deck of his mega yacht boning up on the tax code of the Cayman Islands. He doesn't have time for that. He may not have the skills or inclination for that either. So the expertise that wealth managers represent is hard to replicate. It's not easily duplicated or replaced. And that's one of the secrets to this whole thing. Remember, I said there are just under 3,000 billionaires in the world. In the world of criminology, it's a very common finding that, say, 20% of a city's population is responsible for 80% of the crime. Or maybe it's only 10% of the population is responsible for 80% of the crime. Likewise, in the world of offshore finance, a tiny, tiny, tiny group of people is responsible for most of the problems of spiraling wealth inequality and lawlessness and impunity that we see. And it's not just the oligarchs themselves. The wealth managers behind them, as you can see from our network diagrams, it's not uncommon for a wealth manager to have, say, 3 to 5 or 10 clients even. So the number of wealth managers who are actually doing the most damage to the rule of law and to the world economy, probably number in the hundreds. It's a very small group of people. So the good news is this is a very solvable problem in terms of scale. If you know where to direct your energies, policymaking, normative, etc.
And have there been any other policy challenges like this that have been very similar in maybe a completely different way, but because of the network structure and because of what you've learned about that, is there any other problems like this that have been solved in the past with policy decisions that would give us the blueprint of things to try?
You know, I'm not a public health specialist, but I believe the story of dealing with cholera epidemics was that for centuries, there were misconceptions about what was causing cholera. People were getting these diseases from unclean water, but you know, without a germ theory of disease, without an understanding of transmission, it was hard for people to understand what was causing it. So there were all kinds of false starts, like people being poor, or it's people living too close together. And then a doctor named John Snow famously did an analysis that showed, oh, it starts with the water. And in particular, there's this pump on Broad Street that's making a lot of people sick. So I'm just going to take the handle off the pump and see what happens. And like, voila, very profound results from that. So I think most of the efforts to address collective problems end up being spent in just pinpointing where the leverage is in solving the problem. A lot of time gets wasted in sort of false starts, misdiagnoses of the problem. And I think that's been the case as much for the offshore finance crisis as it has been for public health. But once people zero in on what's the equivalent of the pump handle on Broad Street, then you can see a lot of positive change in a fairly short period of time. And I think our research really helps us get closer to identifying the pump handle in offshore finance.
And Herbert, just to finish, what's your wish list? What would you like next in this? Is it more data? And if so, what's the data? Is it more data analysis techniques? What would be the sort of the dream next step for you in this?
Yeah, so there's a lot of work in progress already because we only look at 4 regimes. Looking at these from all the different countries in the world, better understanding the mechanisms that push the decisions. We talked a lot about motivation in terms of what are the forces that cause clients from different countries to like go offshore in certain areas, right? So better understanding these motivations from a very macro and global scale is sort of our next step, I'd say. And part of this equation is also leveraging a lot of new tools in, say, natural language processing. ChatGPT is a new toy that everyone's playing with. We might be able to get more structured data from that as well. So I'd say getting more data by augmenting the existing data set, but also just expanding the lens that we're looking at, not just for regimes, but all of these different countries that are contributing to like offshore centers around the world.
And for you, Brooke, what's the next stage for you? What are the dream list?
Beyond the limitation of the kind of clients that wealth managers can practice their profession with, I would say the dream list would be to revalorize civic virtue, meaning pay your fair share of taxes, don't dine and dash on the rest of us, value the rule of law and uphold it with your own behavior. I'm old enough to remember when, while privileged people may have cheated legally or financially, they wouldn't dream of bragging about it publicly because it would be such a shameful thing to do, like bragging about beating puppies or something. And there's still places in the world like Denmark, where I lived for almost a decade, where it would be severely socially sanctioned to say, I don't pay my taxes. You little people can do it for me. Or I'm not going to obey the law. At least formally, you have to pay lip service publicly to the idea that everyone should be equally subject to the rule of law and everyone should pay their fair share. America has changed really, really drastically just in my lifetime. And if you factor in my parents' lifetime, when they were little children, people going to the movies would see specially made Disney cartoons that were made to build morale during the Second World War. And the gist of those cartoons, which featured Donald Duck, was if you're at home instead of in uniform, the most patriotic thing you can do is pay your taxes. There was this public consensus that it was unthinkable that you wouldn't pay your taxes. It's really only since the Reagan era and greed is good that it's become increasingly socially acceptable to take a predatory attitude towards society, to say, yeah, I rip off the benefits of society and I don't pay for them. It's like bragging about being a shoplifter. But, you know, many of the revered wealth creators in the world right now, especially in the United States, say exactly that. Yeah, I don't pay taxes and it makes me smart. Look how rich I am. If I had billionaire money and I wanted to influence public opinion, one of the things I would do is harness the power of social media and popular culture to bring us back to that world that many living people still remember, which is the world where it was not okay to brag about being a shoplifter on society, that it was actually a point of pride to say, yeah, I pay my way. I contribute to the society that privileged me and allowed me to grow rich. I'll close with a funny story. When I lived in Denmark, people used to say to me, a colleague for the first time said to me with a straight face in 2010, I pay my taxes with joy. As an American, I kind of stared at her after she said that, and I waited a beat, waiting for her to go, ha, 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 you know, just kidding. And then I realized as the seconds passed that she was 100% sincere. And I was like, whoa, I wonder if it's just this person or if this is a more widespread thing. And it turns out it's a widespread thing. It was so striking to me because I remember the very first time I finally made enough money to pay taxes. And what I felt was not resentment. I was proud. It was like a mark of adulthood. Like, I finally make enough money that I owe the federal government something. Like, how cool, I've passed a rite of passage. What I'm talking about is not like going back to Victorian or Elizabethan morals. These are the social norms of pre-1980. And if you look at, particularly in the US, what's happened with inequality and so the relationship between productivity and wages, we see a massive shift on the one hand of wealth and productivity with the benefits of it going to a very small group of people on the top who are not paying their fair share. But we also see a dramatic drop off in all the quality of life measures. Like, I believe right now the US is the only developed country where life expectancy is actually going downward. That's pretty dramatic. So in the 70s, or like right about the time Reagan was elected, when it became okay to say, I'm going to dine and dash on the rest of society, or I'm going to predate on all you middle-class people who can't afford wealth managers, when the rest of the world was getting nationalized healthcare and strong social systems, tuition-free university, the US just dropped off in the other direction. And in many ways, it now looks like a developing country. Like, we have maternal mortality rates and poverty rates that in some places approach those of some of the poorest countries in the world. And yet we also have a huge proportion of some of the richest people in the world. We're all in one country. And the reason that this divide has emerged is in part because it is socially acceptable to take a predatory approach to society and say, I'm smart, I'm high status, because I take without giving back. I would try to change that.
Brooke, Herbert, thank you very much for being on the show. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Simplifying Complexity, where we look at the key concepts of complexity science with expert minds from across the world. Concepts like emergence, self-organization, adaptation, networks, scaling, tipping points, and much more. This podcast was produced by Brady Haywood and Wavelength Creative. To make sure you don't miss an episode, be sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. I'm Sean Brady, and I'll see you in our next episode.